they had at hand, overwhelming individual warriors with their fists, clubs and bayonets. Once they had unloaded, some brave lander crews returned to Cadia, honouring promises that they had made to the men left behind, and some of them were successful, carrying another load of veterans from the dying world. But increasingly, as demons began to manifest all over the planet, fewer and fewer landing craft made it off the planet. And soon, the flow of escaping men ceased completely. General Gruber was on board the last evacuation craft. He had personally supervised the loading of most of his army, and once the window for flight was almost closed, he finally agreed to leave the planet. He moved along the lander, hand to the walls to steady himself as the craft lurched upwards through the howling storms. By the time he had reached the cockpit, there were armed ratings standing by the door.
"Sorry, sir," the nearest said. "It's locked."
He was a tall, dishevelled-looking man with a slight stoop and thick lips which made his speech indistinct. Gruber articulated crisp, aristocratic words in contrast.
"I would like to speak to the captain. Let me inside."
The man touched his hand to his hat in a navy salute.
"Sorry, General. The bridge is locked."
Gruber bristled visibly.
"Then unlock it."
The man laughed.
"It's locked, so you and we cannot get in."
"I am General Gruber of the Cadian High Command," Gruber said.
"Well," the sergeant said with a wry laugh, "looks like you failed."
Gruber barely understood what had happened until he felt the hands of the ratings on his shoulders and realized that he had the sergeant by the throat pinned against the metal sheeting wall.
"How dare you?"
he was hissing. And the sergeant was gasping for breath as Gruber's thumbs crushed his windpipe. There was a moment's satisfaction. Then behind him, he had a brief glimpse of one of the Navy ratings lifting the butt of his shotgun. And it all went dark. Gruber's head still hurt when the lander docked with their war-capable craft. The air on the ship smelled of oils and the stale, damp scent of purifiers in need of a good scrub. But it didn't smell of smoke. The absence was as noticeable as the stillness. The only sounds were the muffled groans of the ship's superstructure, the dull clangs of enginarium shafts, the low hum of atmosphere pumps. There were no explosions, no gale, no tearing groan of a planet coming apart. The ship felt almost normal. The Navy ratings worked the airlock, briskly clamping the lander into place. Gruber took in a deep breath as the final doors opened. He had lost none of his dignity as he led the Cadians onto the ship. It was a tub of a craft that had been carrying foodstuffs in its vast hangar bellies and still smelled of slab and fermented protein slop. Gruber had arrived back on Cadia in the personal quarters of War Master Rice and his staff from the Deucalion Crusade. It had been a jolly trip with axelwood dining chairs, long tables, and the best Arcady pride from the personal cellars of the War Master. It was the kind of transport that Gruber had become used to. He faced this slab hanger with ill-disguised disappointment and took in a deep breath. The Imperium had failed them, and this was what the heroes of Cadia were reduced to, being ferried from the ruins of their home in a third-rate food carrier. Chapter 11. Kazamairak. Without their vox, the fighters of Kazamairak had no idea that the planet was doomed. There were 25 of them left in a guild hall, with their backs to the river. The Volscani were coming at them from all three directions. Minka had just shot a flamer-armed Volscani. She was waiting for his partner to show himself round the corner of the building opposite when there was a sudden flash and a roar of noise. She thought for a moment that it was another flight of marauders passing just overhead. The collapsing buildings did nothing to dispel this idea. It was a marauder on a bombing run. But the roar got louder and buildings about her began to fall. And then the earth started to shake. Minka pushed herself up. She thought she could stay on her feet, but the tremors were so violent that she was thrown onto her face. The roof above her crashed down. The wall she was sheltering behind fell outwards into the street. The whole earth was shaking, and Minka howled in terror, her voice lost in the tumult. The quake went on for an age. At last, Minka pushed herself shakily to her feet. Her city was gone. Statue Square, Divination Street, the Ilium Block. Even the high crags of Myra Cathedral, where they had camped for the first week of fighting, were all gone. Everything they had fought for, inch by inch, block by block. There was nothing. Not a single brick or block of rockrete was left standing. All about her was a field of broken rock. Only the city walls still stood, but the 100-yard-thick rockrete defences had been broken into sections and scattered miles from where they'd once stood. Minka spun around. She looked about in stunned silence. Nothing moved. No one. Only the Myrak River, swollen and full, still flowed east. An aftershock passed, and a gale began to grow. Then something moved. It was an arm. She picked her way across. It was Tarvi. He was covered in dust.
Thrawn,
he swore as she pulled him free. Minka, is that you? Yes, she said.
What happened? I don't know. Where's Wrath?
Minka looked around. She tried to guess where the rest of the company were. She picked her way along the top of the ruins. The ground beneath her was rubble and dust. Minka set her foot on a slab the size of a Leman Russ. It shifted under her feet. She paused for a moment, trying to overcome her fear.
Wrath! She shouted. Wrath!
There was movement in the rubble. Minka used her hands to pull the debris away. Fingers were grasping for her.
Help!
A muffled voice was saying. Minka scrabbled at the rubble, grabbed the hand and pulled. The debris fell away, and in a terrible moment she saw the shoulder plate. It was a Volskani trooper. She let go of the hand, pulled out a knife, and drove it into the place where shoulder and neck connected. She felt the body tense in pain as she moved the knife around, looking for the artery. Warm blood bubbled up over her hand. She pulled a knife free. The gusts knocked her sideways, whipped dust storms of grit and rubble low across the ruins.
Anyone?
She shouted to Tavi. He shook his head. Minka put up a hand to protect her eyes. She'd fought for these ruins for over 100 days, and now it seemed that a kind of victory had come, with the irony that the city itself had been flattened. Tavi's footing was uncertain as he made his way towards her. He took hold of her arm to steady himself. There was movement beneath them. They knelt down and started to pull the bricks back. Someone was in there. Minka could hear a voice.
It's Wrath, she said, and scrambled till her fingers were raw. Tarvi, it's Wrath!
The two of them worked furiously. Wrath cursed as they lifted the rocks from his chest. He was grey with dust. He winced as they pulled him up. It was like helping an old man to stand.
Thrawn,
he said, and fell back. They draped his arms over their shoulders, and Wrath hung on them like a dying man. He straightened his limbs slowly, groaning with each movement. They carried him to the side of the river and set him down. Minka felt under his arm. He winced as she moved her fingers along his ribs.
They're broken, she said.
She knew how to bind his arm to his side, but she had nothing to strap it with. She hunted about for a scrap of cloth. A vast column of black was rising in the northern sky. None of them knew what this all meant.
What the hell has happened?
Wrath said. Tarvi looked to Minka.
I don't know, she said.
Wrath sat up. He blinked as if there was something wrong with his vision.
What happened to the river?
Minka turned. The water was rising at an alarming rate. Something has blocked it, Tavi said. Within a few minutes, the river overflowed its banks. The rising water started to lap across the wharves towards them, dark and thick with sediment. Minka and Tarvi dragged Wrath a little way up the bank of rubble. They sat as the waters rose, Wrath with his arm bound to his side, his face grey with dust and pain. Aftershocks kept rippling across the ground. On the hills above Kazamairak, fires were starting to grow. They were the red, baleful light of magma pushing its way up through the crust of Cadia. Rivers of fire were starting to flow down towards them. They sat waiting, but there were no enemies to shoot, no reinforcements. Minka tried to find her way back to Statue Square in the hope of locating their vox, but it was useless. Her city was unrecognizable, the ruin heaps unstable, and she could not tell where Statue Square was or had been. When she got back, Rath was where she had left him, propped up against a piece of rockcrete. Tarvi was standing over him. Volcanic eruptions were reaching higher and higher into the sky. They cast the only light. "So," Minka said, "what now?"
"We'll hold the city and await reinforcement."
Minka gestured towards the strange flatness that had once been Kazimierz.
"What city?"
She was sitting, staring out over the ruins, when she thought she heard laughter on the wind. It came again from a different direction, then again, streaking across the sky. It was a wild, insane sound. Minka looked up to the darkening sky. The temperature began to drop, and Tarvi caught Minka and pulled her up to her feet. Laughter came from a thousand voices all around them. Minka felt the rubble beneath her shift. She ignored it at first, but then it moved again. She stood. "There's something moving," she said. They looked down as the rubble shifted again. Someone was clawing their way up. Tarvi and Minka pulled the stones away. They saw a hand, bloody and raw, reaching up for them.
"Cadian!"
Minka shouted as she saw the cuff. Within moments, they found an arm, a shoulder, a head of dust-grey hair, and a dusted face was staring up at them. It was Olivette. He thrashed and kicked against the weight holding him back.
"It's all right," she said as she pulled his arm. "You're free!"
Olivette pulled at her. He pulled so hard he dragged her towards him. Minka fell forward. He embraced her and turned his face towards her. She thought he was going to kiss her in gratitude, but then there was pain, and he was gripping her so hard that even when she had both hands pressed against him, she could not push him off. She could hear the shouts of Rath and Tarvi, and she screamed when she felt Olivette's teeth grind down on her ear and tear it. There was blood on her hand. He'd ripped half her ear off.
"Calm down," she said,
and Rath grunted with pain as he pulled her away. Olivette kept thrashing, his body pinned down at the legs. He was not kicking against the weight of the rubble, but to get at her, Minka realized. The sight was chilling.
"Shoot him," she said.
Tarvi strode forward. He lifted his las rifle.
"Stop, or I'll shoot,"
he said, as Olivette thrashed about, waist deep in rubble.
"Just shoot him," Rath shouted.
"In the name of the Emperor,"
Tarvi said, then fired. The shot hit Olivette in the head, but it had no effect. He fired again, and again, pumping the Cadian with las rounds. Half of Olivette's head had gone by the time he fell back.
"What was wrong with him?"
Minka gasped. "He was driven mad from being buried," Tarvi said. "He didn't know what he was doing." Minka pulled her legs away. Yes, she thought. He was driven mad. Thrawn. They'd all been through enough to be driven insane. Mad was what they all agreed. But then, she felt something move beneath her. Another hand appeared a yard to her side. Then another, 20 feet away.
"Look!"
Humps of rubble were starting to rise from the ruins of Kazimierz. A Volscani pulled himself up, dragging his foot free, and then charged. Tarvi hit him with the butt of his rifle. There was a crack as bone shattered. The blow slammed the Volscani sideways, but he barely paused. He hit the ground and then pushed himself up and came at them once more. Tarvi fired. The lasbolts hit the Volscani in the thigh, chest and shoulder before he went down. But then another Volscani rose, then two, then five. A Cadian appeared, loping over the ruins. Half his head was missing, but he stood shakily and turned towards them.
"Gunnel?"
Minka called. The thing that was Gunnel snarled like a beast and started forward. A hand caught Minka's boot. Its nail raked the leather, catching for a moment on the heavy steel buckle. She stamped down hard and felt the crunch of bone. The fingers were broken and misshapen, but they still clutched for her.
"Rath!" she shouted. "We have to get out of here!"
Rath was fumbling with his knife. Minka pushed her knife back into its sheath.
"They're dead," she said. "They're all dead."
She pulled Rath up, and they half fell down the slope towards the river. Tarvi covered them. Another torso burst out from the rubble slope in a shower of rockcrete and dust.
"Tarvi!"
Minka shouted. She grabbed a piece of wood and swung. He crunched into the thing's skull and knocked it from its feet. Suddenly, they were all shouting and firing. Wrath found a gun and tossed it to Minka. She caught it and fired two shots into the back of the thing clawing upwards. In the corner of her eye, she saw something right itself and turn towards her, low and hunched like an animal. It might have been Noel. She couldn't tell. He died a while ago. His corpse was swollen with death, rags of guts hanging through the torn uniform. The stench made her eyes water. Minka fired. The putrid flesh burst as each round struck it, like a pustule popping. A living man would be dead three times over, but the cadaver kept coming towards her, mouth hanging open, eyes rolled up into its head. "Tavi!" she shouted. Another Cadian, like the first, head bandaged and bloodied, the stump of one arm waving as it struggled to come towards her. Minka fired. The second blasted part of the thing's skull, but it did not stop. Then two more figures appeared. They had been dead for months. The flesh was dark, bones showing through where the guts had rotted away, the hollows of their eyes empty. One was a civilian woman, and the other a child, weeping pockmarks on its dust-grey face, dark eyes glittering with malevolent intent. Minka fell back. All she could hear was her own panicked breath and the thunder of her heart beating loudly as another two cadavers appeared before her. Minka fired into each of them at point-blank range, even though she knew it was useless. Lasbolts burned holes in the rotting flesh, but the corpse's body did not flinch. Her foot skidded on rubble and blood. She saw the flash of steel. She and Wrath were back to back. "We have to get out of here," she hissed.
"Tavi!"
Wrath shouted. But Tavi was down and unmoving. Wrath cursed as he decapitated one of the dead, kicked another over with the flat of his boot, swung wildly at the one with the bandaged head. His knife opened it up from sternum to navel. There was a dull pop as the skin and muscles of its front parted and the grey snakes of intestines flopped out. A man would have screamed, but this thing came on regardless, its booted feet trampling on its own grey and bloated entrails. It slowed for a moment, then toppled forward, its legs hopelessly entangled and fell onto its face. Minka was too terrified to scream. Wrath had her by the shoulder and was pulling her back.
"To the river!"
Wrath hacked through the arm of one, took the head off another, and heel-kicked a third out of the way. They skidded down a scree slope and hit the bottom as rocks tumbled down upon them. Minka's jacket caught on the barbed wire. It tore as she pulled free. As more undead crested the slope behind them, one fell forward and skidded face down after them, arms reaching over its head. It was carrying an auto pistol. Wrath bent to rip it from the dead hand.
"Here,"
he said, and tossed it to Minka.
"Come,"
he said, and took Minka's hand and pulled her down towards the river. The water was foul with scum and oil. They pulled each other into the shallows. The river's banks were choked with flotsam that lapped the ruined banks. Minka grabbed a piece of wood and threw herself on it, as Wrath caught a floating drop canister and held onto the end. The dead splashed down to reach them, but they kicked out into the middle of the river. Wrath was having difficulty keeping his head above the water. The cool water soothed the burn on Minka's palm. She used her belt to tie him to the canister, and then lashed herself to it as well, and put her hand back into the water.
"There,"
she said, as they bobbed about in the middle of the river and started to drift downstream. The current swept them around the exposed wing of a crashed marauder. The wing had caught trailers of barbed wire and wood. Where the city wall crossed the river, there was a black tunnel. They were carried swiftly towards it by the flood.
"Look,"
Wrath said. Minka turned. Behind them, shambling figures were throwing themselves into the water.
"They're following," she said,
and looked ahead. Figures were coming down to the water before them. She saw a child standing on the wall above the tunnel entrance. It hit the water with a splash. She cursed as she felt a hand grasping at her foot and she kicked out wildly. She closed her eyes and prayed as the black hole of the river tunnel swallowed them. Chapter 12. Lord Lieutenant Beric. Naval Subaltern Granis had had little personal experience of the Astra Militarum, but from what he had heard from other naval officers in the Amasek bars of Port Moore, Cypramundi, the average guardsman was only one rank above the feral world savages. On the 18th upper deck of the Claymore-class corvette Lord Lieutenant Berwick, Grannis clipped his ceremonial carapace breastplate into place and drew in a deep breath. Before this had all started, he'd spent the last 20 years touring the wilder reaches of the Scarus sector, collecting tithes of meat and furs and grain from feral worlds whose unkempt populations needed to be cowed into submission with a show of force and ceremony. 6 months earlier, he'd been enjoying Amasek on the agri-world of Black Lake. They'd spent 3 weeks loading their hull full of grok slab and were supposed to be moving on to the next planet of Connaught's Guard, but received new orders to make all haste to the Cadian system. The Lord Lieutenant Berwick had barely begun to deliver its load of grok slab to the planet when the augury scanners showed a solid mass of contacts reaching from Vigilantium to Solar Macarius. Enemy hunters. The rumour had gone through the ships, and the air on the bridge was tense. There had been 3 days of urgent unloading before they'd been forced to disengage from orbit and seek shelter in the solar flares around Prozen, a bare and blasted rock close to the Cadian sun. The solar radiation had wreaked havoc with their systems, and 3 machine spirits had given up the battle, plunging large sections of the ship into darkness as the maintenance engines spluttered and failed. But that failure had probably saved them from detection by the sleek Black Legion Idolator-class raiders, whose precision targeting systems were even able to pinpoint ships that were sheltering closer to the solar flares. For the last 3 months, they'd been playing a deadly game of hide-and-seek. The stress of being hunted had taken its toll on all the naval crews. They'd been surviving on a mix of stims and slab. Grannis himself had not slept well for weeks. And then the Phalanx had arrived, and under cover of the vast warship, Imperial ships began to shelter. It was commonplace craft such as these that answered the call when the evacuation of Cadia came. Third-rate officers like Grannis, who found themselves involved in a deadly military operation. There was a knot in Naval Subaltern Grannis's shoulder. It had been getting tighter all morning. The last time he'd taken on Imperial Guardsmen was 15 years ago, and he'd never quite forgotten the experience. The Catachans had broken every rule in the book. They had lit fires in their hangar, killed 17 canteen servitors, and beaten Subaltern Reln and his fire-suppressant teams to within an inch of their lives. He adjusted his ceremonial cravat, lifted his shoulders to his ears, then rolled them back. He remembered the consternation the guardsmen had caused. There was a time when embarked troops who killed members of a ship's crew would have been quietly vented in the outer reaches of a planetary system, but the intercession of a 300-year-old Mordian general with an unusual sense of humour had persuaded their captain to impose lockdown instead. The Catachans had been given bare rations and water, and then they had been sealed within their hab hangars for the whole month of warp travel. It was Grannis who had drawn the short straw that trip, and was sent to see if they were still alive to tell them to prepare for embarkation. He still bore the scars of that encounter, both physical and mental, and they weighed on him now as he paused for a moment, before the full-length mirror on the back of his polished Nalwood door, drew himself up to his full 6'3" and tilted his hat to a severe angle that exaggerated his long, hooked nose. Savages, he reminded himself, cowed by a smart dress uniform and a polished breastplate. He adjusted the angle of his tricorn hat, lifted the dueling sword off its peg, and checked the straps of his father's brass-hilted hotshot las pistol. He flicked off the safety catch, set the charge to full, and puffed out his cheeks. He was ready. Gruber's left leg was bandaged above the knee, but otherwise the 180-year-old warrior was unharmed as he awaited the arrival of the ship's captain with an honour guard of majors. He saw the doors to the crew lift grind slowly open and took in the movements of the shotgun-wielding naval ratings with ill-concealed dislike. He had not forgotten the indignity of his treatment on the lander. He would never get over the shame of losing his planet to the enemy. As the naval officer walked towards him, Gruber drew himself up to his full 6 feet. He had spent long enough on board ships of Battlefleet Cadia to know the many ranks that the Navy kept, and how they were indicated. And he took in the red tricorn hat, the gold-worked dueling sword, and the epaulets of this officer, and knew that the man was no captain. He did not wait for the customary greeting from the naval officer, but took a painful step forward. The Navy ratings lifted their shotguns. Gruber refused to be cowed.
"I am General Gruber of the Cadian Shock Troopers. I must complain about the way we have been treated. We have received neither food nor medication. You must rectify this at once."
The subaltern smiled apologetically.
"General Gruber, my name is Grannis. I am subaltern on this craft. I apologize. My only excuse is that this is a time of war."
He paused and collected himself.
"First, I should welcome you aboard the Lord Lieutenant Beric, but I must remind you that our ship has not been used as a troop transport for over 15 years. We do not have the rations to feed you all."
Gruber took another step forward.
"I have thousands of wounded and hungry men, heroes, each and every one of them."
Grannis flustered for a moment, bearing himself up.
"I repeat, General, what you ask is impossible. We are doing the best we can. I repeat, the Lord Lieutenant Beric was not provisioned for troop transport. We are making arrangements now to have you moved to another ship."
Gruber stepped forward.
"Why has your captain not come to greet us?"
Grannis fumbled clumsily for an answer. Gruber cut him short.
"I demand that you allow me up to the bridge. I have to make contact with the forces of the Imperium that have escaped from Cadia. It is imperative that someone takes command. Is that understood?"
Anyone who had lived as long as General Gruber knew how to blend rank, gesture, and threat into one heady mixture. Grannis had spent too long intimidating feral world savages. There was nothing about him that Gruber found anything but comical. 5 minutes later, the bridge doors of the Lord Lieutenant Beric opened, and Gruber entered with 30 of his Cadians. On the bridge of the Lord Lieutenant Beric, there was a hush. All eyes were on the green sweep of the augury scanners. The blips of the phalanx flashed brightest, and about it the small pinpricks of Battlefleet Cadia and the evacuation fleet. But it was the empty spaces around them that everyone was concentrating on. They all knew that the Black Fleet was out there. None of them doubted that the enemy ships would make another attempt on the fleet. The massive guns of the phalanx would deter the enemy, but the lure of bait would prove too strong. Not even the phalanx would keep them off. The augury flared green as it swept round with a low beep at each circuit. Captain Zabuzko was concentrating so hard, he had quite forgotten about Subaltern Grannis. When the bridge doors opened, he looked up, his expression turning to surprise as he saw an Imperial Guardsman enter. The man shouldered past the astonished ratings and came to a halt just inches from the ship's captain. Zabuzko could not remember the last time a guardsman had stood on his bridge. The image was strangely incongruous. It was typical of these times. Things were falling apart.
"What is this?" Zabuzko demanded. "Grannis, what is happening?"
"Captain,"
the guardsman said, addressing him directly. Zabuzko took in the other man's bearing. He was tall, fit, lean.
"I am General Gruber," the man said, and put out a hand.
He had clearly been through rejuvenate treatment, perhaps 30 or more Terran years ago. His skin was slackening and the pinched scars gave his mouth a slight sneer, but nothing could take away from his grim black eyes.
"I am General Gruber, Cadian High Command. I am commandeering this ship."
Zabuzko stiffened.
"I beg your pardon, sir."
He turned to face the man before him. The dais he was standing on gave him a good 5 inches on the other man.
"You are still within the Cadian sector. This is a state of war. As a surviving member of the Cadian High Command, I am taking over control of your ship," Gruber said. "I shall return command to you when I am done, but in the meantime, you will obey me. Is that understood?"
Captain Zabuzko did not answer. He took in the 30 Cadian shock troopers who had followed Gruber out of the lift, and he gave Grannis a withering look. At last, he said,
"My ship is yours, sir."
"Good,"
Gruber said. "My men need feeding. Please arrange whatever food you have to be distributed among them.
and bring the Vox officer. We need to find the Lord Castellan.
A staircase wound down from the bridge to the communication chamber of the Lord Lieutenant Beric. The Vox servitors on the Beric were a trio of mind-slave torsos, set into a seat of wires with tubes running from their eye sockets and mouths, their servo hands leaving a scroll of minuscule Gothic on the pink Vox sheets.
Granus,
the captain said, and the subaltern escorted Gruber and his command staff down. They took in the wires, the servitors and the long sheets of naval communications that fell in folds on the floor. Lalink, one of Gruber's aides, lifted the Vox feed and scrolled through it. It listed naval engagements, ships lost, page upon page of Battlefleet Scarus communications. On the planet, he'd heard little of the naval battles, but now he took in the list of lost and missing ships of Battlefleet Cadia. The scale of the fighting seemed overwhelming.
Any mention of Creed?
Lalink stirred himself.
No, sir.
It had been a long time since Gruber had been so hands-on. He looked at the crude communication array.
How do we work these things? Granus?
The subaltern stepped forward.
Let me know what you want, sir.
Gruber looked at the servitors. They were almost skeletal, and they had a mouldy scent.
I want a message sent out. I need to find Creed.
Granus had the orders relayed to the other ships in the fleet. Answers came back over the next 4 hours. Each ship's captain had their own peculiar manner. Some of them offered condolences in formulaic phrases, congratulated Gruber on the courage of his warriors, or, from the battleships, sent offers to have Gruber transferred to their craft. But as to Gruber's question, each of them replied in the negative. They had interrogated the soldiers in their care, asked for rumours of Creed's presence. No one had seen the Lord Castellan. As far as anyone knew, Hasaka E. Creed had not escaped the planet. For years before this moment, Gruber had been just the sort of old guard to have opposed Creed's rise. Creed had snubbed him a number of times, and Gruber had complained many times to War Master Rice about him. But now, as Lalink read out each message starting with a negative, Gruber found his spirits flagging. He did not want command. He had been part of defeated army groups before and knew what was required. The troops needed rousing. They needed their broken spirits restored. The scale of the defeat was such that it needed a master to reforge the Cadian spirit. Gruber knew that he was not up to the task. If ever there was need of a maverick like Creed, it was now. It was typical of Creed, he thought, to disappear at a moment like this. He turned his back and felt all the eyes of his men upon him. Servitors scratched on the slow, raveling message scrolls. Gruber closed his eyes.
Well, until he can be traced, or until another member of Cadian High Command can be found, relay the message that I shall take command of the forces of Cadia.
The evacuation fleet was scoured for all the surviving staff officers of Cadia's High Command. On the Lord Lieutenant Beric, Gruber gathered officers from 17 different regiments, different uniforms, wounded, dirty, bandaged. Tenders shuttled back and forth as Gruber set up a Cadian command in exile. Surviving generals, adjutants and orderlies shuttled to the bays of the Lord Lieutenant Beric.
Bring them through the food hangars, Gruber said. Let them see how low we have sunk. Let them see the cost of our pride.
The officers were all grateful to be given a task, a purpose. But there were no officers from the Cadian 8th, Lord Castellan's own. Their absence was noticeable. Their first task was to collect data, to find out which units had been salvaged, what was their number, what equipment they had managed to carry off the planet. The communication array started to overheat with the rate of dispatches and reports that were coming in. The scent of cooking flesh filled the room as the Vox servitors' plug sockets started to steam. If they felt pain, they did not show it. Hour by hour, General Gruber established command structures over the Cadians. It was like taking rags and stitching them back together into a recognizable garment.
This is General Gruber, he broadcast to the other ships of Battlefleet Cadia, of High Command. I am seeking Lord Castellan Creed.
Over and over the response came back. Not on this ship. Have they checked the wounded? Gruber asked. And again the response came back. Yes, sir. Anything? Negative, sir. The final sightings agreed. Creed was last seen fighting on the Elysian fields. The Eighth were with him. None of the evacuees knew what had happened to him. It was a fact that they would have to accept. Creed had been lost with Cadia. The captain had gone down with his ship. They would have to continue the fight without him. All the time, the fleet was being set upon by Black Fleet fighters. Ships and interplanetary landers gathered together. They were like a flock of sheep when the wolves are howling. For 2 days, there were hit-and-run attacks on any vessel that fell too far behind. Cadians who had survived the fall of their planet were lost as their craft were ripped apart by Black Legion broadsides. Throughout the fleet, there was an atmosphere of tense fear. And then, the attacks ended. They were still days from the closest viable Mandeville point, but the Black Fleet had pulled back. No one knew where they had gone, or when, or if they would return. Relations between the Navy and Astra Militarum commanders had become tense. Gruber had a voxlink raised to Admiral de Armitage of Battlefleet Cadia. Admiral, any trace of the enemy? Gruber demanded.
None, sir.
I know our foe. They will be back. Have your crew stand at the ready. Is that understood? There was a long, icy silence before the Admiral spoke.
I know my business, General Gruber.
I'm sure you do, Gruber told him. And I know mine.
Then do not lecture me.
Gruber paused for a moment to collect himself.
Admiral, we both faced the Black Legion. You in space, my men on the ground. I would like you to note that the soldiers of the Cadian shock troops are undefeated. After 100 days of fighting, they were finally winning the battle on Cadia. Your fleet, however, failed to defend the skies. 100 days. And who kept your troops alive? Who kept them supplied? Who evacuated your troops from the planet at much risk to themselves?
Your fleet, Admiral. The service of the Imperial Navy has been exemplary. Accept my apologies, but please, do make sure that the fleet stands ready.
I shall.
Gruber did not argue any further. He had made his point, but the Admiral clearly had something else to discuss.
Any news of the Lord Castellan?
None, Gruber said.
Does that mean you are the sole surviving member of Cadian High Command?
I am the most senior officer, yes.
Then I would like to invite you to relocate aboard my flagship, the Grand Alliance, de Armitage said.
Thank you, Admiral. Is there space upon your ship for my soldiers?
How many do you have?
There's 40,000 upon the Lord Lieutenant Beric.
General, my ship is a beast of war. It is not a transport. I'm afraid that many troops would affect the performance of my crew. I regret to say that I could not take so many on board, unless direst need compelled me.
Gruber nodded. Then I thank you, but I cannot accept. It was on this craft that I found shelter, and I will not leave them. If the Lord Lieutenant Beric is good enough for them, then it is good enough for me. Gruber's presence on the ship meant that it was deemed necessary for the Lord Lieutenant Beric to be shepherded into the middle of the Imperial fleet. It was a small, ungainly ship amongst the lean silhouettes of battle cruisers and escorts. Day and night, Gruber worked with the passion of a convert. Despite his bluster with the Admiral, he knew that he had failed Cadia. All the High Command had. Creed had told them that a Black Crusade was in the offing years before, and men like Gruber had wasted that time in pompous and self-congratulatory banquets where they toasted their own achievements and mocked the upstart Werrywart, who saw nothing before them but doom and darkness.
You should rest, sir, Lelink told him, but Gruber refused.
Lelink pointed.
Sir, look, your leg.
Gruber looked down. Fresh red stains had leaked through the dressing on his leg. He had forgotten, and now he was too busy to stop.
Fetch the medicae. He must be quick. That is so much to do.
The Medicare was an old man with soft hands who cleaned the wound. As he pulled a fresh, clean bandage from his sack, Gruber paused, and the Medicare looked down.
Yes, he said, I have requisitioned the ship's medical supplies. Clean dressings.
It was a wonder that only someone who had been on Cadia all this time would appreciate. Gruber drew in a deep breath and felt a wave of emotion rise within him. He put his hand to the Medicare's shoulder.
We fought hard, he said, didn't we? Yes, sir. We fought beyond the last clean bandage.
The Medicare put his hand on top of Gruber's own.
We won,
the old man said, his soft hands warm on the general's own.
We defended Cadia. We drove the enemy back. We won the battle.
General Bendix was among the officers summoned to the Lord Lieutenant Beric. He stood in the lift as it brought him up from the slab freezers. He was a little apprehensive as he waited to be shown through to Gruber's command post. The loss of Cadia meant a strange new reality had come upon this world. He drew in a deep breath, put his shoulders back and stretched out the ache in his neck. There was an odd smell, he thought, like cooking slab. An aide stepped into the room. He wore winter camo. It was not unusual to see men dressed in all kinds of uniform. The soldiers were wearing whatever they'd been evacuated in. General Gruber will see you now, he said, and saluted. Bendict took the steps down to the communication chamber. There were three servitors, their styluses gently scratching as the message scrolls wound onto the floor. Gruber had one of the scrolls in his hand. He looked up as Bendict entered, let the paper fall in folds to the floor. He held out a hand.
General Bendict, he said, I am glad you could join me here.
Bendict looked about.
It is a long way from the Fidelitas Vector.
Gruber gave him a long look.
You are right. It is. I wonder what happened to War Master Rice.
I do not know.
No.
There was a gentle ping as another message came in. Gruber read the scroll for a moment and then looked up.
General Bendict, I hear you saw Creed in the last days of Cadia. Can you tell me anything of that?
I did, Bendict said. He came in a single Valkyrie to a bunker. It was named Salvation 9983.
Ah, were you part of the Salvation?
Do you know where he went? Bendict shook his head. No idea, I'm afraid. He said he had many places to go, something like that. We were standing on the edge of a mountain, a parapet, 3,000 yards high. It was blowing a gale at the time. It was clear something was afoot.
Bendict paused. I heard that he was last seen fighting on the Elysian fields. He ordered my troops there. We were within 10 miles of his position when the evacuation order came. It got very messy. I assumed he had got off the planet.
Thank you, Gruber said. He seemed distracted and then drew himself up.
Your account supports others. It appears that Creed was lost on the Elysian fields.
There was a long silence as they assessed the weight of that statement.
Can I be of help, sir?
Yes. We need new command structures. Decimated units must be brought up to strength. I want army commands, divisions, battalions. I want a functioning army by the time...
He paused, and the question hung in the air.
Well, wherever we end up.
Bendict put a voice to the question many of them had been thinking.
Where do we go?
Gruber swallowed. There was only one place they could go. The place that would need defending, once the Cadian Gate had fallen.
There is only one place. Holy Terror.
Chapter 13, Myrak River. The forces that had held the Immaterium at bay burst like a rotting carcass. Red, weeping wounds ripped across the sky. And through the tear in the fabric of sanity, Warp Beast feasted on the millions of cultists the Black Legion had brought to Cadia. In their crazed minds, the heretics lifted their arms to the demons, as if welcoming salvation, and the Warp Beasts fell on them like rabid hounds,
tearing flesh and bone in an orgy of killing and cruelty, and sucking out their screaming souls as a hound sucks out the marrow. In this hell, Minka and Wrath struggled along. They had left the river 2 miles behind, dragged themselves up from the ruined banks, their route driven by the safest-looking one before them. Demon hounds were baying behind them, and Wrath was flagging, supporting his weight on Minka's shoulder as he limped along. She refused to give up yet. "Just a little further," she said, though it wasn't clear that there was anywhere for them to head to. "Keep moving."
"We're done," Wrath said. "Stop. Let us die here."
"No," she told him. "Just a little further." Demon hounds were baying around them. If the beasts caught their scent, then their end would be swift. Minka dragged him forward. She was heading she did not know where. She just knew that she could not stop. But at last, Wrath said,
"I cannot."
His face was pale with pain. He winced as he put a knee to the ground, like a man giving feudal homage to his lord, but Minka grabbed him by his shoulders and tried to haul him up. There was a thunderclap in the sky above them. The red light was bright enough to cast shadows on the earth. And then there were excited howls. The hounds had caught their trail. She could hear their bloodthirsty baying. It was a horrific sound, like the scream of a million insane voices. Wrath was not moving. She shook him by his shoulders. She did not care if she hurt him.
"Get up, damn you!"
He groaned, and she spun around, looking for somewhere to head towards. She could not give up. Her training kicked in. "Find a defensible location. Keep fighting."
"Look," she hissed. "See that?"
Wrath looked up. Through the ash clouds, there was a white shape, about half a mile before them. It was hard trying to see in the ruddy light. "It looks like a lander," she said. They staggered forward. The hounds were all about them now, baying and laughing.
"It's crashed," he said, as they drew closer.
But as they approached it, Minka could see that he was wrong. It was a planetary lander. The landing gears were down, and there were lights inside the cabin.
"Come on,"
she hissed, feeling almost giddy.
"Maybe we're going to make it off this planet after all."
It was hard to appreciate the size of the craft until they got close. It was much bigger than Minka had thought. The ramps were closed, the engines dead, but the cockpit lights shone out. It was so big they could walk underneath the thing without bending over. But there was no way up. Even if she stood on Wrath's shoulders, she did not think she could reach the access ladders. Minka stared up at the thing, put her hands to her mouth and shouted,
"Hey!"
The hounds were getting closer. She tried climbing up the landing gear, but there was no access. She stood under the ladder and jumped, but fell back, not even coming close to catching it. She jumped again, but fell even shorter this time.
They were so close,
but there was no way aboard. Wrath's voice was low and warning.
"They're coming," he said.
Minka turned. In the darkness, glowing red hounds were bounding towards them. The howls seemed to ring out all around them. Minka only had the auto pistol she had salvaged from Kazamirak. She pulled Wrath next to her, their backs to the landing gear. If this was it, she, like Cadia, was going to go down fighting. The Lord Lieutenant Beric. When he was told the destination was Holy Terror, Admiral D'Armitage communicated his concerns.
"Lord General, I do not know if we can make any translation at all. The warp is in tumult."
"Well, it's death to stay here."
"You're right."
"So, what are the other options?"
D'Armitage paused.
"We could sail out into deep space, power down, wait for the Black Fleet to pass on. Warp storms pass."
Gruber listened to the Admiral's plan. It was an option if time was not a priority. At the end, Gruber said,
"That is not a route that is open to us, Admiral. You have 10 million of the Imperium's finest fighters stowed away in the hulls of Battlefleet Cadia. They need to be used, to be put into the war, to take revenge."
D'Armitage was silent. It was Gruber who spoke again.
"Who is the best navigator in your fleet?"
D'Armitage paused.
Hippolytus Frem.
Good. Send him to me. We will find a way, Lord Admiral. I promise you that.
Hippolytus Frem was locked away in his chambers, but his twinned pair of rattling attendants had been fretting about the empty, sterile chamber for hours. Gruber found it hard to tell whether they were genetic twins or had been through intensive augmentation. The similarity of their movements made him think they were bloodkin, but they had a disconcerting habit of moving and speaking in synchronization. They seemed almost reflections of each other, as they stood in embroidered jackets of black velvet. After an interminable wait, there was a low chime, and the two rattlings bent their heads towards each other and began to speak in low, hushed voices. "Is anything wrong?" Gruber demanded. They turned to face him, their movements synchronized like man and reflection. They spoke together.
"The ways of the warp are tumultuous," they said.
Gruber nodded. According to Darmitage, Hippolytus Frem was the finest surviving navigator in the Battlefleet Cadian system. He had come aboard the Lord Lieutenant Beric that morning and had been sequestered in the astral chamber for nearly a Terran day.
"If there is a way to Terra, then he will find it," the rattling said.
But it seemed from the delay that their master had not yet found a route. Gruber nodded. He couldn't tell if the abhumans were male or female. They had a strangely androgynous look to them. He found his gaze lingering on their fingers, not narrow and thin as their height might imply, but thick and stumpy. Despite all the strangeness about them, the rattlings were humans. All of them, Ogryn, Navigator, Rattling, the abhumans would share the same fate as the rest of the Imperium of Man. General Gruber paced up and down outside, his staff in attendance. The two rattlings continued to speak to each other in hushed voices. At last, there was another chime, and then a bell rang high up in the chamber, and the two rattlings hurried to the sealed doorway. Something, it seemed, was about to happen. Gruber turned and drew himself upright, shoulders back, chest puffed. There was a long pause before the sealed doors opened, and Gruber had a brief glimpse of a shadowed staircase reaching upwards to a dark chamber. Down the broad steps, a figure descended, slowly and unsteadily, his weight resting on his cane. The rattlings waited by the doorway with an eager and expectant look to them, like a pair of hunting dogs. When Hippolytus Frem stepped out of the observatory on the Lord Lieutenant Beric, a silk scarf was tied about his forehead, covering his third eye. The strain of his search was clear to see. His face was drawn with deep lines. His eyes were red, and purple bags weighed heavily on his cheeks. He was leaning on a walking stick made from the exotic long nose horn of the Aphelian narwhal, chased with gold and jewels. The rattling attendants hurried to help Hippolytus stand. He turned towards Gruber, took in a deep breath, and was racked by coughs. Gruber's face grew pale and drawn as he waited. As he did, one of the navigator's legs started to give way, and the rattlings looked to the general, as if for permission.
"Yes," Gruber said. "Please, sit."
A carved wooden stool was brought from the corner of the room. One rattling set it down with both hands, while the other helped the navigator sit. A bottle was brought, and the navigator took a long sip of thick, dark syrup.
"So," Gruber said, "what news? How long until we can make the translation?"
The navigator's shoulders sagged for a moment.
"General Gruber, the fall of Cadia has set off a tsunami through the Immaterium. I have never seen such tumult. To make the translation to Holy Terra would be death. The warp storms there are terrible. I have never seen such..."
He paused, and then he said with a deliberate look,
"Chaos."
General Gruber stiffened.
"There has to be a way."
The navigator put his hand on the shoulder of one of his rattlings.
"I cannot see one,"
Gruber snapped.
"Do I need another navigator?"
"They will tell you the same, or they will fail."
There was a silence as Gruber paced up and down, punching one fist into his other palm.
After a long pause, he started again. Lord Navigator Frem, it is death to stay. If the Black Fleet does not kill us, then the creatures of the warp will. He paused to collect his thoughts. I have millions of fighting men that must reach Terra. They must get there before the enemy does. The future of the Imperium of Man depends on this. We have to reach Terra. The Navigator nodded. His sunken eyes were shot with blood. He appeared genuinely sorry, the bags under his eyes heavy with fluid.
I must rest, General Gruber. I promise you this. I will look again. But I have to warn you that I do not hold out much hope. The Immaterium is breaking. There are warp creatures following us. I have seen them. They are but pale reflections of what awaits us in the warp. While a Gellerfield might hold them off, I do not know how long it would last under a sustained attack.
Chapter 14. Pax Imperialis. Captain Berger banked, turning his Fury void fighter sunwards. It was a standard patrol, six fighters of Squadron Zeta doing a sunward sweep. The blue plasma of the engines of the evacuation fleet, powering out of the system, drifted through his viewport as his fighter turned. Far beyond them, the golden light of the phalanx shone out like a distant moon. Squadron Zeta kept banking sunwards till the Cadian sun filled their vision. The star was now a dull glow in a miasma of red, like a bloodshot eye. Berger accelerated, 60,000 pounds of thrust pinning his hands to the controls, the pressure of his void suit responding, the constant pulse of the blood pump flushing his system through with oxygen-rich blood, starting to strain against the effort. As he pulled out of the turn, he felt the pressure lessening. "Arming weapons," his gunnery officer, Betten, reported. She sat in the nose turret beneath his feet. They'd been in the same crew for 6 years. She was one of the best gunners he'd flown with. Small, efficient, calm under pressure, and when there was no pressure, she liked to joke. It made her good company, helped the long hours of patrol tick by.